Matthew 5, 1 through 12. And seeing the multitudes, he went upon a mountain. And when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you, and they say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So, the Beatitudes is the beginning of the Sermon of the Mount. Sermon of the Mount is in Matthew 5 through 7. So the Beatitudes is kind of an introduction to that. The Sermon on the Mount was the first of five long speeches that Jesus gave that was recorded in Matthew. These speeches summarize God's instructions to his people. Now, you maybe are familiar with a lot of the sayings that come from the Sermon on the Mount. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You cannot serve both God and mammon or money. The golden rule, therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. Do not think that I have come to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And the Lord's Prayer. These are just some of the sayings that are commonly seen. So, the Sermon on the Mount is about righteousness or right living. Have you ever stopped to think, why is it called the Sermon on the Mount? Could have been called the Sermon on a Mount or a Sermon on the Mount. But no, it's called the Sermon on the Mount. And when God puts emphasis on something, it's important to listen. So he's emphasizing this and he's asking us to take notice. This is Jesus's first long recorded sermon. And in Matthew 4, before this, we see Jesus was tempted in the wilderness. And then after that, he started to call his disciples. And then he went to Capernaum and set up his ministry. In Matthew 4, 17, it states, From that time, Jesus began to preach and to say, Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Then we see in Matthew 4, 18, him calling his disciples. And then we get down to Matthew 4, 23 and 25. And we read, And Jesus went about all of Galilee, teaching in the synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the people. When his fame went throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all sick people who were afflicted with various disease and torment, and those who were demon-possessed, epileptics, and paralytics, and he healed them. Great multitudes followed him from Galilee and from Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. So, we see from this, Jesus was introducing himself to the people. Now, this is his big message to the people after his introduction. In politics, Frequently, you'll have the candidates, they'll introduce themselves to the people via television messages, rallies, things like that, to kind of introduce their ideas to the people, especially the president. And then once he gets elected, then he gives his big address, the inaugural address. So the Sermon on the Mount, I think, is Jesus's inaugural address to the people. So this sermon happened on the mountainside. It was just a normal hillside in Jerusalem, probably similar to any other hillside. Nothing special about it until Jesus was there. This was his address, so that's why it is the sermon. And the area became famous, the Mount, because of him. Nothing else special about it. So, where did that message take place? Can you get the first slide? So, I have to go old school. The laser pointers don't work on televisions. So, this is just a representation, a normal hillside there, and we see the Sea of Galilee in the background. Next. So, just kind of another view, the hillside there and the sea in the background. Next. So, Stacy and I were in Jerusalem, and we were at the area where they assumed was the Mount of Beatitudes. I don't know if anybody knows for sure, but that's what they claim. So, you can see Stacy kind of in the background there. Next. So, they built a church on the area for people to come to. Next. So, where is this area? You can see right here is where they say the Mount of Beatitudes is located. It's on the Chorazin Peninsula, and it's right by Capernaum there where Jesus went and set up his ministry. Next slide. So, a more traditional looking map, you can see the area right there is on the northwest area of the Sea of Galilee. Next. So, you can see here, so the Sea of Galilee is up in this area here. Now, Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist in Bethany here. And then he went to the wilderness and was tempted. They think that's in the area of the wilderness around Jericho. So then after John the Baptist was put in prison, Jesus was left the area and he went up to Capernaum up there to set up his ministry. So, next slide. So, just another look at the area. We can see the Sea of Galilee, Capernaum there, the Chorazin Peninsula. And then if we compare this to a modern map, next slide, we can see right here, this is the area of Bethany, and right by Jerusalem there, right by the Dead Sea, the area of the wilderness there, and then up by the Sea of Galilee where Jesus set up his ministry. Okay, we're done with the slides. So, the Sermon on the Mount starts out with the Beatitudes. Like most books, the introduction frequently is the most important part, because the introduction sets up the idea of what's to follow. It introduces things, ideas that if you miss this, it's real hard to follow the rest of the story. Growing up, my mother was notoriously late for things. So when we went to movies, we frequently missed the introduction. And I kind of got used to it. We would just stay to see the introduction afterwards to kind of put things together. But it wasn't the most ideal part of it. And then I met Stacy, and Stacy was directly opposite. She was wants to get there at least 15 minutes ahead of time so that we don't miss the introduction, because if we do, she's got no interest in watching the movie. So kind of learn from her about these things. So the Beatitudes, what does it mean? So beatitude in both the Greek and the Hebrew means blessed or happy. So when I first looked at this, it did not make any sense to me. Blessed or happy are those who are poor, meek, sad, hungry. I don't want to be part of that group, but this is God's word, and God is always correct. So what was I not understanding about this? How was I misperceiving what God was saying? So this made me look further into all of this. So if you look at happiness from a traditional point where most people look at happiness, who should be the happy people? The actors who have everything, the rich, the people with political power who have everything, the powerful CEOs and that, but how many of these people have you heard that have had problems, either addictions to things, broken marriages, suicide, things like that? So maybe they don't have everything. Why are they searching for something in their lives that they don't have and they can't figure out how to get to? Let's look at Solomon, for instance. So Solomon, by world standards, he should have everything. It's estimated that Solomon generated an income of 666 talents of gold per year. Now, talent of gold is about 63 pounds, or about 1,000 ounces. If you look at current gold prices, somewhere around $2,400 an ounce, he's generating just from gold every year $1.6 billion. Not only that, he had silver that they said was as common as stone. He was a lumber baron. He had all the cedars and that, and they said those were as abundant as sycamore trees. So someone did an estimate of Solomon's riches and worth in 2021 dollars and came up with $2.1 trillion. So you think Solomon has everything? So, but if we look in Ecclesiastes 1:2, he stated, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. In other words, emptiness. So all the world riches are really emptiness. So the Sermon on the Mount, it was written by Jesus as an instruction manual to us, an instruction manual to us as believers of the true way to be happy. I ask you, was Jesus happy? Jesus attracted crowds, and crowds wanted to come to him to hear his talks and stuff. Have you ever seen crowds gather to hear an unhappy person talk? For instance, Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. Did crowds gather to hear him talk? No. Most people that are speakers that people want to hear are happy, energetic, engaging. They are the type of people that people want to hear talk. I think even a better example is children. Children kind of have a sixth sense about stuff. They don't want to go around people that are sourpusses, miserable, that. And they'll tell it like it is. So they're not afraid of that. So, and children gathered to Jesus. Now, If you look at Jesus, he had every reason to be unhappy. So, he was born and died penniless. He was buried in a borrowed grave. He was betrayed by one of his disciples, his closest friends, for money. He was accused of a crime he didn't commit, and he was put into a rigged trial. And during that, he was tortured and killed in a way to make people suffer before they died. And he knew all of this ahead of time. So, would you be happy? So, from this, we can see, yes, Jesus was happy. And he went through this being happy. And this is his message to us. Physical things cannot fill spiritual needs. So, and this is his instruction manual to us. So, Jesus is not talking about worldly happiness. Jesus stated in John 18:36 that my kingdom is not of this world. The Beatitudes are a roadmap that takes us to the kingdom of God. This is a spiritual kingdom. And we need to look at the Beatitudes from a spiritual standpoint. So, let's look at why his message was so devastating to the people in Israel at that time. So let's look at their culture. So Israel was expecting Messiah to come, and they were expecting the Messiah to set up his kingdom. Now, there are different views about the Messiah and why he supposedly was not there yet. And those views kind of reflected the cultural aspect at that time. There are four main groups in Israel at the time. There were the Pharisees. These were the traditionalists. So you can think of their motto as being, we have always done it this way. Anybody seen Fiddler on the Roof, the Father, Tevye? Tradition! So that is their model and how they looked at things. They believed that the Messiah hadn't come yet because the people weren't properly following the Mosaic laws, the Torah. Next group, the Sadducees. These were the modernists. Can kind of look at their model as, we have a better way of doing things. So the Sadducees believed the old ways had failed. And therefore, they needed to come up with a better, more modern way of doing things. Now, this was a much smaller group than the Pharisees, but this was mostly composed of the powerful, rich families. And so they were smaller, but they had more power. If you look at the two views, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, you can see they have polar opposite views of things. So frequently they would fight with each other. Now in Israel, there was the ruling council, the Sanhedrin. This was composed of 71 men. And it was composed of both Sadducees and Pharisees. And like I said, the Sadducees were the more powerful group, and they were the ones that kind of led the Sanhedrin. Now, the third group in Israel at the time were the Zealots. So these were the freedom fighters. So their motto could be, everything we've tried has failed, so let's burn it down. So they believed that the old ways had to just be destroyed at all costs, and they were the ones that were going to do it. And they believed that after everything was destroyed, they could rebuild everything. And then the fourth group was the Essenes. So this group was the isolationists. Their motto could be kind of like the Zealots, everything we've tried has failed, But they go on that since it's all failed, we need to isolate ourselves from all those problems and wait for the Messiah to come and use us to rebuild everything. So, what happened to the scribes? In the Bible, you always hear the scribes and the Pharisees. So where was this group? Well, the scribes is not really a sect like the other groups. It was more of a profession or a guild. So it's usually thought that the scribes fall under the Pharisees. So to put this in more modern terms, these groups were saying religion is, for the Pharisees, external observation. For the Sadducees, human philosophy. For the Zealots, social activism. And for the Essenes, could be thought of as geographical isolation. Kind of like monks. Does that sound familiar to modern times also? So, as you can see from this, each group had its predetermined makeup of what the Messiah would look like and what he would do when he got there. And Jesus just never fit any of their models. So, who is the primary focus of the Beatitudes? So, we can see it's probably not the people that were there. So, it was primarily to the disciples. So the disciples were the ones that Jesus was teaching, and he was getting them ready to change the world. So just think about it. You've got any kind of organization. You've got a leader. The leader is surrounded by close people, close-knit group that can see the leader's thoughts, how he does things, how his perception of things are, and he can mold them. So that's what Jesus was doing with the disciples here. If you look at his big message, there was a huge crowd. I've seen anywhere estimates from 30,000 to 125,000. So do you think most of those are going to know Jesus? They may know of him, but they're not going to know him. So when he's given these message, it's counterintuitive to everything that they believe. So this message isn't to him, it's to the disciples. And we just happen to be beneficiaries of this. So one of the problems I see happening with these Israelite groups is, what were they mostly concerned with? External things. So worldly view of things. The Pharisees were concerned with exactly following the law. The Sadducees with philosophy and trying to influence people. The Zealots were trying to force their ideals on everybody else. And the Essenes were trying to separate themselves from everything. And none of these principles work. Frequently in current times, we see churches, denominations, and just people in general kind of try to do similar things. Jesus was not trying to get to that, to the external. He was trying to get to the internal, and that was what he was trying to teach the disciples. In Jeremiah 31:33, it states, I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. And in Proverbs 4:23, it states, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it springs the issues of life. From this, it can be frequently interpreted that the heart is synonymous with the mind or the brain. Also in the Bible, the gut is synonymous with feelings or emotions. In humans, we're at the top of the food chain. Why? Because of our brains. Our brains are what makes us who we are. Our brains make up about 2% of our body, but it gets about 15 to 20% of our blood and extracts about 20% of the oxygen from our body. So you think it's important? So our brains is what helps control our mindset and our perception of happiness. And this is God's instruction manual of how to get our minds and our perceptions in alignment with Him. So, how do things get in the brain? Frequently, there's almost a direct connection between the eyes and the ears to the brain. How did Satan trick Eve to cause the fall? So, he initially started with hearing. He said, "Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" Then he used the eyes. "So when the woman saw the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and the tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate." So Satan uses sight and thought and sound there to change Eve's mind and to cause her to sin. Satan's tactics haven't changed. Still uses the same tactics today. So we have to be careful of what we hear, what we see, because these things can change our perception of things and cause us also to fall. So, how does this all apply to us? Bigger question. Has anyone here ever climbed a mountain, kind of like the ones you see in Colorado and that? So you know that if you're going to do that, it's a several hour hike and you gotta be prepared for it. So I look at our Christian walk as kind of like that hike. So when we first start out on both the hike and our Christian walk, we can get all excited about what we're going to do. Oh, we're going to hike this, we're going to get to the top, or the Christian walk, oh, we're going to get to know Jesus better, and we start out all energetic. But just like the hike, after a while you're plodding along, it's the same thing over and over again. You can get discouraged, you can get into a routine, and that's when you can fall or just not continue in the path. But then, like in the hike, you get to an area where there's an overlook and you can see, oh, I started way down there. And it can reignite you. The same thing with the Christian walk. So then you go back and you start walking again, more energized. But if it rained a little bit the day before, you start to slip and slide and you slide back down. And just like in the Christian walk, we're human. We're going to slip, slide, fall. But then you got to remember, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to get to the top and kind of get your mindset right and get back on the path. After a while, again, same thing. Things get monotonous again. You go through the things, but you get to a different outlook and, oh, I've come this far. And maybe you can see the summit up there. Oh, I've only got this far to go. And it encourages you again. And then with the hike, maybe you'll get to the top. Maybe if you're not in shape enough like me, you won't get to the top. But we know in our Christian walk, no, we're never going to get to the top to Jesus until we meet Him in heaven. But we have to enjoy the walk as we're going along the path in the meantime, because otherwise we're going to get bored, we're going to fall, we're going to slide. That's why in hiking, you don't want to hike alone, you want to hike with somebody. If you slip and fall, you want somebody to be there to help you up. The same thing with our Christian walk. We need somebody there to help us to, when we do slip and fall, to encourage us. So, I look at the Sermon on the Mount as the trail, but I look at the Beatitudes as kind of like the legend for the trail. You have to understand the legend in order to understand the trail and how to get there. So the Beatitudes is kind of characteristics that the Christian possesses. Don't make the mistake of the Pharisees thinking, well, if I just imitate the characteristics that I'm going to get there. Also, the qualities of the Beatitudes are byproducts of being Christians. They're not an example of, oh, if I do this, I will be a Christian. They're a byproduct of that. So, examine yourself. Do I have these characteristics? If I do, great, it's encouragement, I'm on the right path. Do you look at yourself and say, well, I've got a couple of these characteristics, but I don't have all of them? Great, you are on the right path. You just got to keep pursuing ahead. Do you look at it and say, oh, I've fallen. I don't have those characteristics and you regret it? Good, still, you recognize that you're not on the right path and you need to get with somebody to get you on that correct path. Or you look at them and say, these aren't for me. I hate this. I'm not doing this. Maybe you're not a Christian. So in future studies, we're going to be talking more about these Beatitudes in detail. This is kind of an introduction to them, and we'll look at how the Beatitudes build on one another to bring us closer to Jesus.